Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
We start today on Beacon Hill, where the House is working through 217 proposed amendments to a police reform bill. At last check, there were well over 100 amendments left to go before the chamber can vote on the bill itself, but things are moving quickly. So joining us now from the State House to give us an update on where we are is WBUR's Steve Brown. Steve, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Steve, we're in the second day of debate. What's the tone been like there at the State House, and where are we in the debate on this legislation?
Well, yeah, we're slogging through things, I guess is the best way you could say. It's hard to read the tone here because there are only a handful of legislators actually in the building and in the chamber. Many of them are participating from home. Now, the key legislators, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, the chairman of the Black and Latino Caucus, who we'll be hearing from later in the show, are all in the building. As a matter of fact, that's why he's not here right now, because they're voting on an amendment at the moment. They're here, but everybody else is scattered about around the state, back in their districts. And on a big bill like this, it makes it go a lot slower, because normally everybody would be here and they'd be literally in the back room talking about amendments. And, hey, how about if, you know, we give you this, you give us that, and the horse trading that goes on. Now it's all done remotely, Zoom, if I guess. I don't know if they actually use Zoom, but, you know how that is. It gets a little confusing, yeah. And everything is slowed down immensely.
Steve, have you ever seen anything like this?
No. I was thinking on the way in. I mean, this is such a hot-button bill. If we weren't in the middle of a pandemic, if the State House was not closed to the public, it's open to members of the press who have a press ID to get in. It's open to the legislators. It's open to the staffers. But it's not open to lobbyists. It's not open to the general public. If this were not in a pandemic, these halls would be teeming with people on both sides trying to get their point across. You would see hundreds of off-duty police officers in the halls here, in the gallery. You would see hundreds of people from the Black Lives Matter movement and the ACLU all up here trying to make themselves be heard. I guess the Red Sox aren't the only ones that are playing in front of empty stands. The Massachusetts legislature is doing that as well.
So, Steve, before we let you go, 217 proposed amendments all in. I know they dispatched with about 40-something yesterday, but that's a lot left. Is there going to be a vote, overall vote today on this legislation, or are there days to go, given how slow this process is, as you were just explaining?
Yeah, I think things might pick up a little bit. They've drawn up what's called a consolidated amendment, which they've taken, I think there were 24 amendments altogether. They put those, and they reworked them. They're not exactly the way they were written, the original amendment was written. They kind of rework it and everything, but they take 24 of them, and they put them all in one amendment, and they say, okay, we're going to have a vote on amendment consolidated amendment A. Which is the one that's floating around right now. They haven't voted on it yet because people are taking some time to read what's actually in it. And something that might be in it, an amendment that might have said, you shall not do this, in the amendment, it'll say, you shall. I mean, it's crazy. So they have to kind of really read every line and see, what does this really do? So that's taking up a little bit of time, but that will move things along faster in that you take 24 of those 217 amendments and just wipe them off the table, take one vote. And the votes take a lot longer now, too, because everybody, as I said, was scattered across the state. Roll calls usually would take 3 minutes here. They're taking on average 20 to 30 minutes for every roll call vote.
Well, it is a fascinating picture of this combination of great urgency and then potentially grinding detail and process. Steve, thanks for illustrating it for us from the State House. That's WBUR reporter Steve Brown. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So now we turn our attention to education and we ask, what is it like to take over an elite boarding high school during a global pandemic and important conversations on race and privilege. So that's the task ahead for Dr. Raynard Kington. He's the new head of school at Phillips Academy in Andover, serving as the school's first Black leader and first openly gay leader. A medical doctor, he most recently served as president of Grinnell College in Iowa. Dr. Kington, welcome to Radio Boston. Not sure we have Dr. Kington. I'm going to check in with the control room. If we don't, we may go to a quick break.
Can you hear me now?
Okay, Dr. Kington, there you are. Yes. Dr. Kington, I can, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
That is the affairs of coronavirus that we have these connection problems sometimes, but we're delighted to have you. Dr. Kington, yours is a remarkable role. It's a remarkable role. It's a remarkable first. It's in a remarkable moment. I want to make sure we get to all of that. But to start, you're just starting. And I cannot believe that this was what you were imagining when you first put forward for the job. So have your priorities for, let's say, maybe your first 100 days changed in the last few months? Are you thinking about how you're going to start quite differently now?
Well, it's not the way I would have imagined starting in a new position. But in some ways, what's helped is that I came from being president of a residential liberal arts college that was dealing with many of the exact same issues over the last 6 months or so. So that has sort of made the transition smoother than it perhaps otherwise might have been. The usual slow, gradual introduction to the culture of the operations of an institution, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. So let's talk about the pandemic for just a minute. You're now running another residential school. It draws in students from around the country and around the world, very much like a college or university. We know, we've had a lot of conversations on WBUR here on Radio Boston, that the entire residential university model might be being called into question now. And I got asked, does a pandemic like this threaten the school's entire model as well? Is Andover in an existential moment?
I don't know if it's an existential moment. I do realize, though, that we have to rethink what it means to be a boarding school in many ways in the context of a pandemic. So obviously we think, and the school has, it's been a part of the school from its very beginning, the idea that when you live together with other students and teachers, that there is a special something happens, that the education is transformed as a result of that experience. And we still believe that that's a transformative part of the educational experience at Andover, but we had to just reinvent it with different parameters in the context of a pandemic. But, you know,
what does it mean to reinvent it with different? I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm curious about that. What does it mean to reinvent it with different parameters?
So first of all, we have to live within these rules that are designed to prevent transmission of the infection. So distance and mask and all the things that are happening at colleges and universities, that's going to happen on Andover campus as well. And the connection is going to be different because we have to also do something that's really hard, which is sacrifice things in order to protect the common good. So it means we have to rethink how we operate. I mean, imagine how closely you were, even in a non-residential high school, how much physical time you spent close to your classmates and your faculty. Well, we're going to have to rethink that and do it in a different way. But we think you can do it and still be safe, but it will be different.
Dr. Kington, I know I'm challenging you with this next question, but you were just talking about the common good. And I think it hangs over this discussion that yours is an elite institution that separates people from the common experience. It's designed to be an elite institution. That elite nature sometimes comes through academic performance, maybe scholarship, but often through being able to afford to be there, up to $60,000 a year for boarding students. In this moment, how do you think about the elite nature of the institution? This call for equity and common good that we're experiencing across the country, and what your role in joining those two things is.
So, I mean, almost every society has elite institutions, and we are an elite institution. But I think Andover has made remarkable progress. Andover is not the Andover that it was 30 years ago. So for more than a decade, we've been need blind. For example, we're one of the few elite boarding schools that's need blind, meaning that the admissions decision is made without regard to the ability of the student to pay. So we have actually a substantially diverse community. I believe over 40% or so receive some form of financial aid. So we're not the image that's in many people's minds about what it means to be an elite boarding school.
I'm sorry. I do want to stop you there for just a second. So are you saying there is not a financial barrier for people to attend?
What I'm saying is the admissions process admits students without regard to their ability to pay. So they're like a number of colleges and universities. Grinnell was also one of these schools that are need blind in their admissions policies. Now, of course, that doesn't mean financial resources aren't relevant, because we all know that almost everything that we look at to assess individuals in some way might be a result of resources. So the quality of your education, for example. But it is not explicitly taken into consideration when the decision is made about who is admitted and who's not. And then once we admit our students, then we figure out a way based on their financial status for them to arrive. And so we're...
We mentioned at the top that you're the school's first Black leader, the school's first openly gay leader. We know that about 6% of students on campus are African-American. What do those firsts mean to you and to your leadership as you start this next chapter?
So I get asked that question a lot, and this isn't the first time I've been in one of these positions. I've been in many positions over my career when I've been the first person of color, or the first African-American, the first openly gay person. So it's not new, I think. And I think the way I think about it is that it does make other demands on me to sort of make sure that I bring broad perspectives into rooms that might not have them otherwise. I know that many students and others will look at me as a role model. And I must admit, if that sometimes can be unsettling, but I appreciate that, because I know that for many people, just being able to see someone like me in a position like this opens their minds in all sorts of ways. I don't think it changes what I do on a day-to-day basis, but it does mean that I think I bring to a lot of decisions my life history, which is what it is, which is a great-grandson of slaves. My father was an Ellis Island immigrant from Jamaica. I'm openly gay. And those experiences influence who I am and how I make decisions. And that's a good thing. So I just try to do the best job I can. And I try to make sure that I bring these additional perspectives to how I make decisions and how the institution is led.
You know, one of the things that fascinated me as I was reading about you and preparing to talk to you, you're a medical doctor, you've been president of a university, you're in the middle of a 100-year medical crisis. You have a background in institutions like the National Institutes of Health. You've chosen Andover now. Why this choice? Why is this what's next for you?
Well, I've always taken jobs that I thought were interesting first. and this appealed to me because, an institution that is known for its academic excellence, but as important, it is also an institution that has tried in its 240 plus year history to evolve, to respond to a changing world in all sorts of ways. And that really impressed me. And I thought I could make a difference. So that's what appealed to me about the position.
What is the most radical thing that you either envision or aspire to in terms of transforming your institution for the next era? Because we're clearly coming out of something and into something new.
Well, I would say there are two things that I've been thinking a lot about. One is, you know, education has spoken for in education policy circles for many years about this need for individuals to learn how to learn on their own, sort of, and they have a life of learning. This idea that, you know, you'll be educated for a period of time, then you'll stop learning is just not the reality, and doesn't prepare one for a rapidly changing world out there. And I think this one interesting thing that may come about as a result of the pandemic is that more people have been forced to try to figure out and take more responsibility for their own learning. And I think that might have long-term consequences. So I think sort of figuring out how we can use this moment to help people prepare, our students in particular, prepare for a life of learning and not just sort of these discrete segments.
That is Dr. Raynard Kington, the new head of school at Phillips Academy in Andover. Thanks for joining us. We started the hour today at the State House, where the House is working through 217 proposed amendments to a police reform bill. We got an update then from WBUR's Steve Brown. We are joined now on the line by Massachusetts Representative Carlos Gonzalez, chair of the Massachusetts Black and Latino Caucus. Representative Gonzalez, I know you have to go back and forth through the chamber, so thanks for joining us here on Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So to begin, I know there are a lot of amendments still to consider, but on balance, where does the House stand right now in terms of an overall vote on this legislation?
Well, we're hoping that we can get through these amendments by later on this evening and be able to pass a bill late tonight.
That would be soon. Are you expecting to be able to accelerate and bundle some of these amendments to get there, or have you gone through the gnarliest of those amendments now?
Well, we're looking. I think there's a couple of amendments that have already been consolidated. I think there's going to be some that are going to be roll called, but I'm optimistic that we will be able to get through this, working through late in the evening, and hopefully vote this bill favorably.
So we have seen some heated debate. The House bill generated a lot of amendments. Not all are created equal in their import and their impact. Where is the controversy, Representative, and why has this been so contentious?
Well, I think that when you are trying to address a long history of systematic racism, you're trying to address and reform law enforcement as we know it. Obviously, in such a short period of time, there's going to be different opinions on how to get to the same conclusion. And I think that's what we're seeing here today. But I believe, and when we met with police unions and police chiefs and individuals that have a stake in this, including advocates and the protesters that are out there demanding for change, the call has been answered by providing a bill that can try to address some of the issues. There's a lot of more work to do beyond this bill, but we're moving in the right direction, and that is the goal.
You talked about a bill addressing some of the issues. You chair the Black and Latino Caucus. You worked with Governor Baker for months on the bill that he released in June. You wrote to the heads of the Senate and House, Karen Spilka, Robert DeLeo, asking them to keep their focus on the core provisions that the caucus prioritizes. Can you tell us, our listeners, what those core provisions are?
Well, the core provisions are basically providing adequate training to our law enforcement officers. In addition to that, we want to make sure that we provide them assistance, whether it's with mental health, counseling, to support the daily demands that police officers have. So POST is a standard training component that will be overseen by an independent body that will not only provide the standards of training, but also have an investigation unit that will be assigned to address misconduct when it is reported, and then a oversight board that will make the determinations whether a officer will be getting certified and then be able to get decertified if he or she does not meet the standards of the training that they receive, as well as their obligations to the oath that they took.
Representative Gonzalez, I didn't realize you weren't done with your list. Please go ahead.
Okay. In addition to that, we requested that in our demands that civil service review be reviewed, because we need to be more inclusive in the law enforcement institutions. When you look at the state police that are basically close to 90% white and male, I think that's a problem. So we need to look at civil service, how it's impacting recruitment efforts, how it can increase diversity within our law enforcement, including our corrections office, including our municipalities, being able to have a police force that looks like the community that they serve. That's one. And then the other issue was looking at a commission that will study systematic racism. I think that's critical and important, because we're trying to address in a short period of time many of the 300 years of racism that has inflicted pain in some communities more so than others. We have a huge amount of poverty in some communities. We have $8 of wealth in communities of color. So we need to address that. So it's not only about police reform that we have to address, and this bill will do that, but we also have to look at equitable changes that can lift people up from poverty and provide them opportunities to purchase their homes. And
so
I can go on and on about the ills.
Yeah, I know that you have limited time, and there are some things I think it's essential we get to. We've been covering this for days, and the hot point, or at least one of them, seems to have been qualified immunity, which we've talked about, we've explained to our listeners here on this show. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear qualified immunity in your list. So I have two questions for you. Is that not the most contentious component? And in your mind, since that seems to be a sticking point, how important is addressing that component to you in this bill now?
I believe that the communities of color are demanding to hold police officers accountable when they are accused and charged with misconduct. We've seen, I can talk to you about Springfield, police officers that have been fired for misconduct, rehired, fired again for misconduct, and rehired. That system is broken. So holding police officers accountable for misdeeds is important. Now, qualified immunity, 10 days ago, I don't think anybody knew what qualified immunity was. Again, it wasn't part of our core plan, but we understand the dynamics that it plays in holding police officers accountable. So we took an initiative to look at it, review it, and I think that in the House bill, we have it when a officer gets decertified, he or she will not be allowed to utilize the defense of or be protected by qualified immunity. So that's where we stand today. I'm happy to vote for that House bill that will, again, decertify somebody without the ability to have a defense of qualified or be defended by qualified immunity.
So I think I'm stumped, because you're really sounding like this is not a big deal. This is something that's going to clearly be able to go through. There's a way to do this. And you are expressing optimism about tonight, but we've heard so much heat on both sides, on the sides of police officers, on the sides of advocates. We've heard great tension. A tweet last night from Representative Nika Elugardo tweeted last night after the vote on Amendment 116, which would ban no-knock warrants if children or anyone over 65 are present. Here's what she said, quote, "I just cried for the first time over a vote. 83 of my House colleagues voted for at Rep. Liz Miranda amendment to protect children from the violence associated with no-knock warrants. 83 of 160 protected our babies over an armed, trained officer who determined his life is not in danger," end quote. Steve Brown at the top of the hour told us, you know, people can't be in the State House watching these proceedings. What is going on there? Is this more divisive than things that we've seen in the past? Are you finding yourself needing to lead in a different way to move us forward? And is our community as a commonwealth going to get something here that is going to move us forward?
I think it's important that when you are in a leadership role, you can't lead with emotions. And there's many emotions on both sides. It's important to bring people to the table, to have hard and difficult conversations, but also to agree to move some things that you agree with to a position where you can come to some agreement. And I think that's important. And again, qualified immunity is very important. I strongly believe that we need to look at it. We look at it hard. But again, I think 10 days ago, nobody knew what qualified immunity is, and everybody has taken a stance on it without real clear understanding of what it is and what's the implications beyond police. So we're going to stick with our core issues. Qualified immunity is in a sense, a issue that needs to have further study, I believe. And again, I'm going to not lead with emotion. I'm going to hold, we're going to ask that this bill hold police officers accountable, that if they are found to have misconduct, that they could be independently investigated and charged and convicted and decertified. And I think that's the goal, and that is the mission that we're staying focused on, and that's what we're going to hope to achieve by this bill.
So my last question for you, we spoke with Chelsea Police Chief Brian Kies on the show on Tuesday. He expressed both concern about the speed at which this was happening, but also the level of inclusion for officers in drafting in the drafting process of the House bill. We also spoke with Rahsaan Hall, director of the Racial Justice Program for the ACLU of Massachusetts. He said he felt officers had undue influence over the bill. Are you satisfied that all parties have had appropriate input, and as a result, it's possible to come out with a bill that will satisfy the broad range of people who have a stake in this?
That is our goal. Again, that's what folks elected us to do, to come here with open minds and be able to negotiate difficult situations and be able to come with a product that can be in the best interest of the community at large. This is not a police bill. This is not a community bill. This is a bill that's going to lead Massachusetts into addressing police misconduct, reforming the law enforcement institutions, looking at diversity within our police departments, and as well as studying structural racism and making some significant recommendations to address those ills. We have, after this bill, we have a lot more to do, but I think this bill moves us in the right direction at this moment, and it answers some of the cries, not all, but some of the cries of the many thousands of protesters that took to the streets in Massachusetts and across the country.
That's Representative Carlos Gonzalez, chair of the Massachusetts Black and Latino Caucus. Representative Gonzalez, I know you're in the thick of it there, so thanks for taking a few minutes to join us here on Radio Boston.
Great. Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
It's a great weekend for the beach, mostly sunny, 85 to 90 Saturday, 88 to 93 on Sunday, cooler at those beaches.
And that is WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein tempting us with beach weather. But going to the beach has become a lot more complicated this year with social distancing rules, parking lots filled to capacity, and some public beaches limiting or restricting access for non-residents. What has been your experience? Have you had to wait in a long line to find parking? Has your favorite spot limited access this year? Are you worried about crowds at beaches because of the pandemic, and maybe you're not going to go, even if it's the only way you can stay cool this summer? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So let's talk now to a community struggling with how to strike the right balance. We have with us Safatia Romeo Taken, the mayor of Gloucester, who joins us now. Mayor Taken, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. I don't know if it's
Mayor Taken, I'm hearing
today
a little echo back. I wonder if you could turn off anything you might have in the background.
I have nothing on in the background, unfortunately.
Okay. All right. It might be on my end. So, Mayor Taken, what was that first thing you said? You don't know if it's beach weather today?
Yeah. You know what? We did have people at the beach today, and I'm sure that, you know what? They got your weather. They say, listen to your radio show, and it's right on spot. I'm sure they're safe.
Yeah. Well, last weekend, people did go out to the beach. And in your case, the city limited parking access to residents only. Now you're partially reversed that decision for this weekend. Good Harbor and Wingersheek beaches, parking is open to non-residents with limited capacity. How are you thinking about that? What's the thinking you're having to do behind who gets to go to the beach now under this pandemic?
Can I tell, every year we've done this. It has not, it's not a new thing. It's not, it's just that we have limited residents also because of the COVID. But every year we set a certain amount of parking spots for residents and certain amount for non-residents. And when the non-residents are full, we stop and we say residents only. So it's a normal thing for us. But this year we had to cut back. The first 2 weeks in June, we cut back even on residents. We just had to make sure that during high tide, during we have the plovers at Good Harbor Beach and what it can maintain and how people are respecting one another in the COVID, and we checked it, so we'll open up a little bit. And so the first 2 weeks of June was just for the residents to see how they went. Then we had limited. So we've been doing that since day one, except because of last week, the high tide, there's no way. There's absolutely no way that we could have opened it for not even a two extra cars because of the plovers at Good Harbor Beach, because of what we found previously. We had over 70,000 people. We're a community of 30,000. So it was back to back, and there was no beach left to social distance, and there was absolutely it took us 2 days to clean up what we had. So we made that decision.
So let me stop you there, if you don't mind, because that number is breathtaking. So yeah. What about social distancing? What about mask compliance? How are you thinking about enforcement as the leader of a community with a popular beach?
Okay. And during the Just Residents, we hired rangers now. We have park and beach rangers that we had go around and asking people. We're not forcing people to wear masks, as we know, because the beach and the outside is the lowest risk. But social distance, you know, please, and please do not play games. Do not play your volleyball, your frisbee, and all of that. We're limited that to have respect for one another. And it works pretty good. And so this week now we have the tide is in our favor. So we're going to open it up. Like I said, weekly I'll look at the tide. And this week we have a very good low tide at the peak, so we'll be able to have access to more beach. And we're going to see how that goes. And we have the rangers already in place. And, you know, at Wingersheek, which is a larger beach, you know, we have, the rangers walking around there doing the terrains. We have, like, the three-wheelers that are out just to check around some of the areas where the boating areas are. We're just, you know, telling people to enjoy it, respect one another, stay a little bit apart. We ask people to wear masks. We have all the signs up, but we're not saying, you know what, you're going to get arrested, here's a ticket, or get off the beach if you don't have it. We cannot do that. We will not do that. We want people to enjoy, especially little kids in the water. You know, you'll go through masks, the sand, and everything else. So we're not that hateful. We're trying to protect ourselves. I'm trying to protect everyone, so because we were 2 weeks with no COVID, and then it went up to five. So you know what? We know that's going to happen everywhere. It's not just Gloucester, but you know what? We'd like to make sure that, you know what, all our kids join and everyone goes to school in September. We don't want to have Massachusetts, you know, skyrocketing because we don't want to respect one another. And I feel that by doing this and letting people know it's not against you, it's the tide. Follow the tide, and I'll always put it on all the social medias. It'll be on the website, but I tell people, remember, look at the tide. If it's peak high tide, don't even bother coming because I'll have to close the beach, but after that, come on down.
All right, and that is Gloucester Mayor Safatia Romeo Taken. Mayor Taken, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your weather report because it's always right on. So look for the tide, too.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We will.
Bye-bye.
So let's go to the phones for a minute, 1-800-423-8255, to tell us how you're thinking about beaches. And if you've gone, what's your experience been so far this year? We've got Lillian on the line from Cohasset. Lillian, go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for having me on. So I have been to three beaches in the past 2 weeks, and I've had to wait at every single beach that I've been to in line, in our cars, socially distant, just to park. Not to get on the beach, but just to park. And for myself, three beaches is the limit. If I can't get in on the third beach, then I'm just going to have to call it quits for the day. So,
Lillian, how long have you waited in your car?
The most I've probably waited is about 45 minutes. No, definitely not longer than an hour. It's definitely okay, you know, it was okay to wait because, you know, we're all in the AC and we're socially distant. We feel safe. And then finally, when you get to the beach, I mean, once you get there and you find a spot where, you know, it's open enough and you set all yourself up, you've got a couple hours on the beach left. So,
Well, I'm glad you at least would get a couple hours at a time. Thanks for that call, Lillian. And we want to continue to have this conversation. So we have two more guests to join us. And listeners, keep calling in with your experiences. Are you going to the beach? Are you concerned that you're not being given access to beaches by communities that maybe are restricting parking or restricting to resident only? What kind of COVID appropriate or inappropriate behavior are you seeing on the beach, and how are you reacting to that? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So joining us now is Beth Tytel, a Boston Globe reporter and a friend of the show. Welcome back, Beth.
Delighted to be here.
Also with us is Jennifer Hewer, Managing Director for the Center for Health Policy and Law at Northeastern School of Law. Thanks for joining us, Jennifer.
Thank you. I'm excited to join the conversation.
So, Beth, let's start with you. The beach is supposed to be that fun, carefree experience. Wow, not so much this year. It's complicated.
Oh, so true. I love what Lillian was talking about, waiting for the beach. It made me realize that the beach is kind of like the new RMV. Like, how long are you going to have to wait just to get this little thing? I thought you put the question, so you framed it in such an interesting way, Tiziana, when you were saying who gets to go to the beach. The pandemic, of course, is just putting a magnifying glass on privilege and the haves and the have-nots. So on one hand, we're told you can't visit friends inside, you've got to get outside. On the other hand, it's really hard. You realize there's only a limited amount of outdoor space that where people want to hang out. And so people who don't have cars, it's harder to get to the beach. People don't live in one of those towns. When you think about what the pressures of the beach used to be, like, oh, you've got to make sure the sunblock's on the kids, or like fighting off the kids' request to go to the snack bar. That just makes it look like nothing. Like, that was a quote day at the beach compared to what we're doing now. Like, oh my God, this wave is bringing somebody really close to me. It's definitely up the pressure of the beach. I will say, I just read a great word before coming on your show. There's something new called a trikini, which is two-piece bikini with a matching face mask.
Oh, there's some serious fashion going on there. I'll have to check that out. So, Jennifer, there's a lot in what Beth just said. I could turn that into like 6 or 7 different questions for you, but let me let you cherry pick the one or two things that Beth was just talking about and invite you to react, and then we'll go to the phones.
Sure. I think Beth brings up a really great point about the haves and the have-nots. And when we're thinking about restricting or limiting access to something, which, as even Mayor Taken pointed out, happens frequently anyway, even in a non-pandemic environment, but even more so during a pandemic, to what extent do we want to exacerbate who doesn't have access to something? And those are real considerations that a lot of managers and leaders and decision makers are thinking about when doing something like limiting beach access. And so even though, you know, the conversation is around limiting non-residents, I have definitely seen some evidence that there's also limiting of residents, just limiting of people in general, but not just limiting access, also limiting what you can do on the beach, right? And so Mayor Taken pointed out, and Governor Baker has made comments about this, is a lot of contact activities are supposed to be limited and excluded from the beaches. So no playing frisbee, no, burying each other in the sand and playing volleyball, that type of thing. Some restrooms are still limiting access, right? Which might impact a person's ability to travel to the beach if they don't have the ability to go home really quickly or to use facilities someplace else, things like that. So these are real considerations that I think decision makers are considering and thinking about. And it's not an easy decision, but there's a lot of factors that go into making a decision about when is the right moment to, and for what reasons you might want to limit access to public space like a beach.
So let's go to the phones. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We've got Bob on the line from Gloucester. Bob, your mayor was on a minute ago. Go ahead, Bob. What's on your mind?
Well, great. Well, residents really do welcome non-residents. We're excited to see them, families, and just having a lot of fun. I think one of the things that non-residents may need to be a little bit more in tune with is things such as trash and just, leaving the beach the way they found it. 2 weekends ago, it was really terrible at Winger Chic and at Good Harbor. And I think if there's just a little bit more cooperation there, I think we'll also find that the relationships between residents and non-residents will even improve more.
Bob, thanks for that call. Beth, this is another element of beach behavior. I mean, we're talking a lot this year about the pandemic and things like masks and social distancing, but what about the other dimensions of beach behavior? Who owns the beach? Are you a visitor or not a visitor? You know, how do you respect the environment that you're in so you can come back to it again? What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, you know, that's such a good point. Right. The thing about the pandemic, it layers more problems on top of existing problems. So you already had people leaving trash on the beach or parking where they shouldn't be or those types of problems. And now you layer around the health concerns and the fact that more people want to go. And then the stress, it just adds, it puts more pressure on everybody. I think one thing that we're all seeing that's fascinating are these photos of people are calling it beach shaming, like the pictures that will go viral of Miami Beach, or just the other day, of course, the picture from M Street Beach in South Boston. And people say, oh, well, they're outdoors and, you know, the risk is lower. And of course, you know, the Globe had some pictures, I think, that were pretty significant. And one of the Globe reporters included a quote from a Northeastern University epidemiologist who said that he thought it was concerning that people were not taking the distancing or mask requirements seriously, even at the beaches, because he was saying that even though, you know, experts strongly suspect that the risk of transmission is lower outdoors, clusters of cases have emerged from crowded beaches and lakes. So, and he said there's a very high chance that someone with COVID-19 shows up at the beach. So I think those shaming, go ahead.
Well, so the shaming is an interesting point, Beth. We happen to have a couple of calls that are so on point to what you're saying that I just want to jump to the phones for just a minute. 800-423-8255. First, we've got Jeremy in Truro. Jeremy, go ahead.
Hi, everybody. Bob, thank you for telling people to pick up their trash. That's a great idea. Out in Truro, the beaches are pretty darn clean because people respect them out there, and the beaches are really not that crowded. So honestly, I haven't changed a thing that I do. I just go down to the beach as if the rest of the world is going crazy and everything's peaceful out there. It's not.
So, Jeremy, if it were super crowded, would you change your behavior then? Well, I think I might have lost Jeremy there. All right. Well, thanks for that call, Jeremy. Yeah, thank you for that call, Jeremy. Let's add one. Let's add Al Marinda, who's calling from Marlboro. Go ahead, Al Marinda.
Hi. Just want to share on Sunday. I usually go to the beach. I leave my house around 3 because I like going to the beach after 3 o'clock. And I went to the cave, to Old Silver Beach. The place was packed. I had to find a little corner for myself, and I thought by that time everybody would be gone, but it was packed, and they closed the parking lot to half. But what bothered me is I had my mask on, and I found a little corner away from everybody, and then people are just not really, I noticed they don't really think about what's going on. They were playing frisbee, they were playing ball. The people were really not, you know, conscious about where they were space-wise.
Al Marinda, thank you so much. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to make sure I've got time to go back to our guests to respond to these two calls. So thanks for calling in and sharing your sort of after 3 o'clock, I'm thinking it ought to not be so crowded, but it still is, and people are just not observing the norms. So, Jennifer, I want to come back to you, and I want to kind of blend this combination of shaming that Beth was talking about before those two calls with this idea that what is safe? We are told to be outside. Jeremy says, hey, there aren't a lot of people around. I'm feeling pretty good about not changing my beach behavior at all. But Al Marinda's saying a lot of people aren't changing their beach behavior, and it is making me feel unsafe. So what level do we know about that safety, you know, from a health policy perspective? And how important or bad is the shaming dimension of all of this?
So I think shaming can sometimes prove to be an effective way of educating people, empowering them to change their behavior, right? And I wanna emphasize the positive aspect, right? Rather than the calling out people for doing something wrong, we can shift the message and say, ooh, maybe there's a better way to do something, right? Like crowded beaches, not super great, but how can we change our behavior even if the beach does get crowded? Or can we prevent the crowding? And so, you know, that brings up the question of what is safe. So the Commonwealth actually has issued guidelines, and they align very well with guidelines that we're supposed to be following anyway, right? As we've all mentioned, wear a mask, try to keep 6 feet apart. But here's what's tricky for beaches. They actually recommend staying 12 feet apart when you're toweling and blanketing, especially if you're toweling and blanketing in groups. And that's, I think, a point that a lot of people aren't catching on to, because I too have seen pictures and I think to myself, ooh, I don't know if that's 12 feet apart, but I bet that's probably because somebody doesn't know. So signage is going to be really important. Continuing to have conversations like this and educating the public about what's the right thing to do and when the right thing to do, you know, making sure you take your trash with you. A lot of beaches and public places have limited or completely removed trash receptacles. So it's not appropriate to just toss your mask or your hand wipes on the ground. And you know, having
so Jennifer, I'm actually going to stop you there, because I'm going to have one more question for you. We're tight on time, and I want to get one more question back to Beth before I come back to you. So I apologize for that. Beth, you've been a bit of a cultural anthropologist over the last few months in your writing about how we are as a human community here in the greater Boston area handling these mandates around COVID. Did anything surprise you about what we're seeing in beaches, or is this pretty consistent with the tensions we've been seeing all along? If you could do that in a minute or so, that'd be great.
Okay, let me be fast. I was thinking that it seems to me that the grocery stores are doing it pretty well. They've set expectations that you're not going to be able to go in if it's too crowded. And I think that's allowed people to feel safe when they're grocery shopping. There's fewer lines outside, maybe because people aren't doing as much panic shopping. And I'm wondering if something similar could happen at beaches. The problem is, when you leave it up to the individual, people either don't know that they're supposed to be 12 feet away, or you get carried away, or they don't care. And I know towns are limiting beaches and people are getting upset, but I'm wondering if there's some way the messaging would be like, you only get a few hours at the beach. I don't have a great answer, but I think that it's probably not surprising what's happening at the beach, because everybody needs to get outside. But I wonder if there's a better way to make to sort of guide people to the right behaviors so people can enjoy themselves and also feel safe.
Mm-hmm. And Jennifer, in our last half a minute or so, picking up on something one of our callers wanted to ask, but we didn't get time. Can local municipalities that own, quote unquote, their beaches close them to people who are not local residents?
Yes, they can. Massachusetts law and common law allow for that. And beaches regularly close to non-residents and residents. There are still some beaches that remain closed to non-residents because they are so small that crowding and public health and public safety issues have made it such that decision makers have said, this is the best thing for us right now. Beaches may close after certain hours or on certain days, or even recently Beverly Beach closed because there was too much traffic and too much congestion. So it is absolutely allowed in Massachusetts, and people do it when appropriate.
All right, that's Jennifer Heuer, Managing Director for the Center for Health Policy and Law at Northeastern School of Law, and Beth Tytel, Boston Globe reporter. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you. Stay safe.